With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to yet another episode of Pilot Episodes. Now, I believe this is episode 4, right? Is this officially episode 4?
Officially, yes. Obviously, we've had a minor sabbatical, but I think it is episode 4.
All right, excellent. Well, that voice that you can hear there is our senior serving officer, Godders. How are you, mate?
I'm good. How are you, JB?
Very, very well. I'm going to go in clockwise order, as I can see on my screen. Duncan Skull Crusher Mason. I'm still not convinced that that's a real nickname, that someone's just given you that and then winding me up. How are you, mate? You all right?
As I said, it's all ironic. Absolutely. Hey, it's nice to be here. How you doing, JB?
Yes, very, very, very well. And lastly, a man they call Anthony Parkinson, but has decided to call himself Big Tony.
Technically, it was Big Tone. But I think we'll stick with Parky. Yeah,
well,
Big Tone, which is also quite ironic.
Hey, it is ironic.
Big Tony wanted, Big Tony gets. So,
and can I just start by saying, Godders, you did good on the hundreds. You came across pretty well, and I know you were sweating about missing tanking on telly.
Yeah, that's because I actually did miss the tanking on telly, but fortunately that hit the cutting room floor.
Oh!
We won't tell anyone, and so did
Hoyley. So that was your sixth prod, was it?
20th.
No.
He spoke before that. He had to go home and get another jet.
So, just so everyone knows what we're talking about, Godders was on TV the other day.
I know. I managed to break in there again. I did it once before, got away with it when I flew James May in a Typhoon for James May's 20th Century, and that was about, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years ago. This one was RF 100. So the McGregor brothers, Colin and Ewan. I hadn't seen it. I thought it was a fantastic program, actually, just following through 100 years of the RAF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's awesome. Did you fly Colin then?
No, I flew Ewan.
Ah, okay.
I pulled rank to get the superstar.
Have you not watched the show, Pucky?
Yeah, I couldn't work that bit out, to be honest.
I haven't watched 100 years, so now you've left, the Air Force is dead to you. Is that what you were saying?
No, I saw it. I just couldn't work out who was in your boot. You were hugging both of them so much, it was hard to tell.
I think that was Ewan was just pleased that he hadn't barfed in the typhoon. Colin was pleased that I think he hadn't either.
Now,
because remember, he'd last flown a tornado.
Yeah.
Now, when you're flying people, I'm assuming Ewan McGregor hasn't got much flying experience. Is that correct?
Yes.
He flew in the back of a two-seat Spitfire. And
he'd had a go at his pilot's license as well, I think.
Right. So how hard can you push a civilian in a Eurofighter compared to, say, if you took up Dunk or Parky?
There are restrictions. So because they haven't done the full training that we've done when we're flying, they haven't done the altitude chambers in case the thing decompresses at altitude. They haven't done sea survival, all these sorts of things. They haven't done the centrifuge, which is the best contraption on the planet. I love that thing. In fact, I ought to tweet. In fact, I can't tweet pictures of my entire bruised body when I got out of that thing for the first time. The centrifuge is, which James Bond film is it with Roger Moore when he's going around in the centrifuge and has to shoot the dials with his watch?
It's good. It'll come to me. He's in America, and it's a late one. It's something like, it's Moonraker, I think.
It's got to be Moonraker, hasn't it?
Yeah, Moonraker.
It has to be Moonraker. So I don't know whether you remember that, JB.
Are you comparing yourself to James Bond?
Negative. He got out of there fine. I was
equivalent. He manages to tank first time.
When they poured me out of that centrifuge for the first time, I was a quivering wreck. Definitely not James Bond material. But, yeah, they take you up to 9G and sustain it.
For how long?
So you get used to pulling 9G, nine times the force of gravity. But you're limited with the passenger because, frankly, if you did that with the passenger, they'd pass out. In fact, I don't know whether you boys had seen it, but there is a very funny YouTube video of a reporter in America goes flying in the backseat of, I think it's one of the Blue Angels. So he's got the open, he hasn't got the oxygen mask on. He's got the boom mic with his helmet. And someone has told him to chew this Arcacia gum or something along that. And the guy goes, ready, here comes 9G. And he's chewing. That's going up and down. And then the bloke pulls 9G and immediately he goes out. He's asleep straight away and his head slumps into his lap. And the guy eases off the G. And his head comes up again into camera shot and starts chewing the gum again. And the guy goes, are you all right? He went, yeah, fine. And that keeps happening. It's flipping brilliant. So that is what would happen if someone wasn't trained properly, maybe.
Well, do you know what, though? I was watching. So there is a lot of, thankfully, there's a lot of RAF 100 stuff on the TV at the moment. And BBC 4 has got a lot of stuff on. And I came up to put the telly on last night. And it had a thing that was done by Peter Snow and Dan Snow, and it was called Battlefield Britain. I think it was around about 10 years ago, but it was a really cool program about just running up to the Battle of Britain and then the Battle of Britain itself. And one of the things that Dan Snow did, they put in a, I think it was an extra, it was certainly a high-performance aerobatic machine. And he wasn't used to it. He went up with Andy Cubin with cubes, and he said, right, here comes 7G. And he pulled 7G, and you could see he looked like he went under a little bit. I mean, he was definitely feeling it. Again, he said, right, this time I'm going to try and, you know, he said, you can squeeze your legs a bit this time, see if that helps. And he said, oh, yeah, it feels a bit better, but he, you know, he was in a pretty, you know, he admitted as he got out of the aeroplane, he wasn't in a great way. So what limit do they put on the Typhoon there if you've got a passenger in, Goddard?
I think it was 5G.
I thought it was 7 because the pressure breathing was good, but that was, you know, maybe mid rules, I don't know.
Yeah, but it was 5. Party went to 7.
I've forgotten already.
A couple of G. Won't make any difference.
I've got a Dan Snow passenger story, quickie. I flew him in a Typhoon. And they were, I don't know what the piece was for, patrolling the sky, you know, defending the skies or something like that. Anyway, we landed and we got out and he bathed quite badly and he was absolutely sodden in his immersion suit, looking pretty bad. And we got the, at the ops desk, we were just signing the aircraft in and we got the, a quick camera and just have a quick squint, check out the footage was good. And we all crowded around and watched this thing play and the screen was completely blank and black other than the audio. And one of the ground crew was like, are there two power switches for it then? It's like, yeah, there's one for the camera and one for the audio. He went, oh, I only put one of those on. So I was like, oh, that's bad. And then we then had to get his sweaty helmet and stuff, put it back on and fly again. And he puked a second time.
Nice. Oh, no. He's a trooper though, isn't he?
It was honestly his expression. And that night he had to give some talk at Hendon. And, you know, he left. I have never seen a mate so shattered. As you know, he was asleep by the time he left the gates, but he was up for it, and he did a brilliant piece to camera on the second trip, feeling like death. It was really cool.
Have you seen the one where Jeremy Clarkson goes into an F-15?
Yeah, he's puking on the nose wheel.
Yeah, very very cool. Yeah, I mean, I guess the overriding question everyone wants to ask is, when do I get into a Eurofighter?
Oh, we'll have to sort out, won't we?
Well, obviously, I mean that is the overriding question.
We'll have to stick you through the centrifuge first. Hey, I do have to say on that though, I think in a Typhoon you could probably take passengers up to 9G just because the kit is so flipping good. Parky would have done the same thing, but in the I had to go through the centrifuge in the US when I went over there and was flying the F-16, and the kit that they've got is fairly old kit. There's a little bit of light pressure breathing, but it's not as much as you do in Typhoon. And trying to hang in there at 9G is some of the hardest thing you ever do. Combat, the basic fighting maneuvers, dogfighting. One of the hardest trips I've done in my entire life was a defensive combat ride where you're looking over your shoulder, you start defensive, and it is all just about maneuvering. You're not always pulling 9G. But that was like sprinting the 100 meters about 30 times. You know, wow. It is full, whip the mask off your face, sweat pouring down your face. And it's not like that in a Typhoon. There's a lot of pressure breathing. The jacket inflates, the trousers inflates, they're full coverage trousers. All you get to feel is the pain.
So how much difference does good kit make?
Huge.
Loads. Massive. Yeah, G-Suit's awesome in Typhoon. The only snag, JB, is you're not a Hollywood star, so Goddess won't fly you.
Ah, is that right? Oh, well.
So what happened was at Lossiemouth, you know, all of the JPs on the squadron were like, oh, that'd be cool, yeah, maybe we'll get to fly Ewan, and station commander walks in, right, boys, I'm flying Ewan. That was it. And you saw, you know, the boy in the program, that was it. He got, you know, 10 seconds on telly, and then Goddess came in and gave him a handoff into the face and said, right, it's me.
It's all about social.
And 2 hours into makeup, you looked all right.
It was the filter they had on the camera.
Sorry, I'm gonna have to ask another boring question. Are flight suits particular to the aircraft?
Not really.
Well, so no. Why couldn't you just buy your own your own suit and then go and fly an F-16, a better suit?
I see what you mean. Yeah, no, the flying suit's just kind of a coverall, but the G suit, is special to the aircraft. Yeah,
interesting. Like why?
Don't know. Typhoon's got a better one.
I don't know. We go and pull some G.
I think they're pretty. So they're pretty similar for a particular period in time. So I'm pretty certain that the F-15, the F-16, the F-18s were all flying with
the same.
And Typhoon came along, and because it was the newest fighter on the block, they brought it out. In fact, F-22 was flying with that stuff as well. But we developed this different system, like I said, heavier pressure breathing, even little G booties, these little G boots that you slip these socks on. I bet you never wore them either, Parky.
But
you
slip them once.
The G suit plugs into them, and that inflates to stop the blood pooling in your feet, and to stop feet pain as well. Because one thing you notice, because the Typhoon kit keeps you awake at 9G, you start to notice the pain of all the blood pooling in your elbows and in your feet.
Jesus,
it's not a nice feeling. I'm telling you.
Goddess had a special anti G jock strap as well. That inflates and got it, you know.
No, that was in the Harrier dunk.
Dunk's never actually worn any G kit because he flew the Harrier for so long.
You're a Harrier, mate. Don't say that.
Good Goddess. I'm proud of you.
Here's an interesting one, JB. The Swiss, I think it was, developed this thing called, was it Lebel, Parky? The Lebel system, which was completely independent of the aeroplane. They just squeeze themselves into this suit. They look like Russian cosmonauts. And this suit had tubes all the way around it that were filled with fluid. So when you pulled G, the fluid was, and it was a particular density, used to get to the extremities quicker than the blood would pool in the extremities and start squeezing against it with hydrostatic pressure. And it was completely independent, so you didn't need a big anti-G system in the aeroplane because the way an anti-G system works is that there's a bleed off from the engine, some sort of depressurizing valve, and then it comes through a pipe that's attached to your seat that you clip into when you sit in the aeroplane.
I actually always thought that it was liquid. That's how I thought that it worked.
No, the weird thing I can remember Typhoon early days was when you checked the pressure breathing on the ground, it felt like somebody kind of got a massive nitrogen cylinder, stuffed a hose into your mouth and turned it on. And it felt like you were just being blown up, you know, with just air being pumped into your mouth. But when you pull G, you don't notice it. And the only thing you notice when you try and talk, you sound
stupid.
Not that dissimilar to normal, any.
Yes, I was just going to say, I don't think he put on anything there, did he?
so let's have a look at them, boys. We've done 14 minutes of what Godders did. What have you two boys been up to last couple of weeks? Any decent flying?
I have flown a single seater and a two seat Spitfire, which was very nice. The Aero Legends one. So we're just getting ready for the season to begin. So hopefully next week at Sidewell should be flying.
Any Hollywood superstars involved in that?
None that I can recall.
I just wanted to check who won.
Oh, just
I saw Charlie Brown. Does that count?
Yes. All right.
So where did you go? What did you do with it? Did you just take it up for a quick shakedown? Or?
Yeah, quick shakedown, 20 minutes, and tried not to mess up the landing. Standard trip, really.
How'd it go?
Did you get nervous? 1,000 hours spit, you'll be all right now.
A bit! I think you always are, aren't you? First one of the year, it's always a bit blimey. I remember this.
Now, when you
What was it? You said Mark 9?
Yeah.
Now, when you take a Spitfire up for a shakedown, what exactly do you do? Do you have your little favourite routes that you like to fly? Do you have a nice scenic route? Or is it very strict? Do you have to do a certain amount of procedures?
No. So, I mean, really, it was just to, make sure everything was good. So just got airborne, went a bit to the north of Duxford and put the gear up and down, flaps, stall, clean, we call it. So with the gear and flaps up, then stalling it. So deliberately flying a bit slow with the gear and flaps down, check that's good. And then some aerobatics and came home.
Any wing drops, anything like that at the stall?
Yeah, just absolutely benign, standard, beautiful.
See, that's one of the things, it's a great aeroplane, JB, that when you can stall an aeroplane and nothing nasty happens, like it flips upside down or any of that sort of stuff, you've got an aeroplane right there.
So you take off, you do some bits, you do some testing, land it. Pick up a check and go home. How about you, Dunk?
Well, I've been for the last couple of weeks. I've been up in Yorkshire flying with 72 Squadron. So we do every 2 years. We have to go to each training squadron, and it's an independent check to make sure their instructors are instructing in the right way. Some of them will get upgrades to their qualification effectively, and so we'll do that as well, and indeed fly with students as well. So it's a really really cool couple of weeks flying everything from upper air work, departing the aeroplane and spinning it, all the way down to doing formation, fighting wing, and at low level, and a landaway. We went over to Blackpool for a landaway with two of the students. So it's been a really, really good couple of weeks.
So I've got two questions for you then. Mm. First of all, who are 72 Squadron? What do they do?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, so 72 Squadron they're a training squadron, and they fly the Tucano. So the Tucano is in its last year of service now. It's when I joined up, Parky and Goddard, I don't think, flew the Tucano when they went through training. I think they flew the Jet Provost. So I was one of the first courses to fly in this brand new machine called the Tucano in 1992, and here I am still flying it, and now it's within its last year of service now. So it trains students to be fast jet pilots at the basic stage of training. So it's a single engined turboprop. It's got it's a remarkably similar performance to a Spitfire, actually. It's got a tandem cockpits. It's quite old, it's quite dated now. There's no glass cockpit inside it. And so 72 Squadron take guys that have perhaps done elementary flying training, so they've just flown a single piston engine aircraft, and they take those guys and they then start moulding them into being fighter pilots. And they have it's a very steep learning curve for the boys, actually. And as I was just saying, they learn to fly in formation at low level, to navigate in this aircraft at 240 knots, and at the end of that they get their wings as a Royal Air Force pilot. So it's a pretty special time for them, and then they go on to the Hawk.
So does that same squadron...
JB, 72 squadron will have been dreading this visit for about 2 years.
is it like the feeling
it's
that...
like the Gestapo coming to visit you.
Is it like... Is it like head teachers and like teaching staff when they hear that Ofsted are like coming over and they all get rather stressed?
But 10 times worse.
Yeah, at least 10 times worse.
Because no Ofsted inspectors are called Skull Crusher.
It was quite hard work for me. I had to polish my jack boots up. I had to make sure that I have some big sticks to whack people with. Yeah, so I mean, it's
how else do they learn, eh?
Say again.
How else do they learn, eh?
Well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's why if they're not hitting them with sticks, then frankly, they're getting it wrong. That's the kind of guidance we give them.
So, would 72 Squadron operate Hawks and Tucanos, or do they have separate squadrons for that?
No, a separate squadron. So, 4 Squadron are at RAF Valley, and they fly the Hawk T2. Mm-hmm. And so guys graduate from the Tucano from 72 Squadron and go on to 4 Squadron before then going to their frontline OCUs.
Excellent. Now, my second question was, what is Land Away? Did you say Land Away? You went to Blackpool and did some...
I did, yes. That is another good question. I mean, it is what it says on the tin. So, which is, you know, you have your home base. And actually, for these guys going through training, what becomes a very normal event of just going to different airfields, whether they be civilian or military, is actually quite a big step up at taking a formation of aircraft, making sure that it's in the right order to go into that airfield and land safely. Actually becomes quite a it's quite a big deal when they haven't done it before, because they get used to it. It's like a sort of a comfort blanket of being at home in your own home. And then perhaps, you know, suddenly going, right, well, you've got to go and cook dinner in someone else's home. So, you know, it's that kind of it's being uncomfortable.
So that's
environment.
So that's very interesting, because you said it is what it says on the tin. When you said land away at Blackpool, I thought it meant flying off the coast. It means actually landing somewhere else.
Yeah, landing somewhere else. And cooking dinner, by the sounds of things.
I was going to say, Dan, did you make them cook dinner? Is that part of the check?
Yes, it is, yeah. They have to make me something to eat.
He gets hyperglycemic quite easily.
If they don't keep feeding me, they're never going to pass.
That's for a future episode. Do not ever let him get hyperglycemic. In fact, we ought to have biscuits around the podcast.
It's all right. The missus has just fed me. We're safe.
Blackpool's a good old place to land, though, isn't it?
That is great.
Bounce the Hurricane there about 40 feet into the air on landing.
No one will have noticed.
So we did actually have something to talk about. I mean, I know we've just done 20 minutes of basically catching up, but we did decide prior to recording you were going to talk about what you believe to be the best fighter aircraft of the last 100 years. Now, I'm not sure. I'm going to let you do it, right? I'm going to let you do it. But if you come back and say either Hurricane and Spitfire, I'm literally just going to stop recording. I'm going to bin it all. So you're going to have to be more inventive.
That's different to the brief, JB.
Is it?
No. So here we go. So I had the idea that we've just gone through RAF 100, right, 1st of April, so 100 years of the world's first independent force, which all of us have been a massive part of for over a quarter of its existence. And I thought it'd be really cool to go and have a look in the books. Most of the ones I've chosen here are just favourites of mine, really, and ones that I would have wanted to have flown, actually, of aircraft through those decades. And we kind of stuck to, well, I'll find out in a minute, but I stuck to fighters. With the RAF, you boys might have gone elsewhere as well, but just to maybe have a quick chat and see whether anyone agrees. So, you know, starting in that 18 to 20s post-war period, as an example, I went a bit left field and picked out a SPAD.
Wow.
Don't even know what that is.
Now, in typical senior officer fashion, it's just worth pointing out here that Goddess let us know this about half an hour before we were about to podcast. Oh, I've got a lovely idea, boys. Why don't you run around and have a look at some of the fighters that you think that you might... I've been doing this all week. So please just trot on, go and see if there's anything you can think about.
Well, I chose Fab. What did you choose for you know, 18, 19, 20, that sort of, the end of that decade? Parky?
Well, I thought you said 20s, 30s or 40s.
All right, we'll go with 20s, because actually I snuck
in. Oh, well, I didn't know. Mine flew in 38.
Poor brief, Godfrey. Poor brief.
Poor brief. So this is how organised we are. But why did you go for a SPAD out of interest? What was
So I went for a SPAD because if you look up a SPAD...
Which I'm doing.
Yes, so look up a SPAD. It's a cool, tiny little, neat fighter that we actually used at the back end of the war and till a little bit after. But for me, when I was on exchange with the Americans on the F-16, one of our sister squadrons up at Langley, the Eagle Base, was the 94th Fighter Squadron, and they were called the SPADs. And their emblem and all of their stuff was Eddie Rickenbacker and little pictures of SPADs from the First World War, because the US had hundreds of these things. And to me, it's just it's a French fighter, but it's just a cool looking fighter that looks a bit meaner than some of those early biplanes. And it's got that link to that US side. So I'd seen an awful lot of it over the years that I was over there. And actually recently when I went back and flew there about 18 months ago over at Langley, you know, it was good to be back on the SPADs again. So I thought that'd be a good little choice.
So the 100 years of the Royal Air Force, you picked a French aircraft that was flown by the Americans.
And us. 19 and 23 Squadron. That's how much research I did.
Yeah, that's wow. Okay. You redeemed yourself.
Did you do that in the last half an hour when you told us?
Well, 1 minute before coming in.
I went slightly more abstract, and this is a bit of an odd one. It was kind of like, what was cool? And I recall when I was younger, maybe about 13, I used to read every now and again those Commando magazine things.
Yes.
Remember them? Brilliant yes. expressions that the German pilots used to say when they got bounced by Spitz. Brilliant.
You still read them.
Oh, I do. Yeah, that's fair. But there was one of them, and I don't know if you guys all know this aircraft, but it was a cool read. It was one of my faves, and it was about the Westland Whirlwind.
Ooh. Oh, yes.
Now, that bad boy flew. So it was a two-engine, but it was pretty modern. It was kind of like a Mosquito, but it was smaller. It was more of a fighter. But yeah. Two engines, so it was meant to go really fast, bubble canopy. But the weird thing, it flew in 1938, which I didn't realise. And it, you know, obviously, it wasn't in the Battle of Britain, and it had massive teething problems because all the Merlin engines they put in the Spitz and Hurries, and they gave this thing the Rolls-Royce Peregrine engine, and it was just a bit gutless with that engine. You know, apparently it was a delightful aircraft to fly and still was pretty fast. They only built about 120 of the things. But if you YouTube Westland Whirlwind, I think it's 243 Squadron, something like that. And there's this black and white shot of all the boys. There's about 30 of these things lined up. They're all sort of ditting on and they jump in them and they beat the airfield up well in their Westland Whirlwinds. And it's just good RAF footage from 1943.
Nice.
And a cool looking aircraft.
Well,
that's a belter. I was on 234 at Bali when we were flying Hawks before they I don't know where they went. It was 234 and 74 Squadron at the time, wasn't it? They'd moved up from Broadie.
So I've got a follow up question for that then. Has there ever been a truly successful two engined propeller fighter?
Oh yeah. A Mosquito.
Mozzie, Lightning.
But, I mean, these weren't comparable to the single-engined fighters.
Yeah, I think the P-38 Lightning, that was the American with a twin boom. Very good, kind of very modern configuration, bubble canopy and nose gear. I think it gave lots of fuel, lots of power. They were pretty fast. They weren't as agile. They definitely couldn't turn as well in a turning fight. But they tended to have awesome firepower, loads of cannons and stuff in the nose. But I'd say what do you think, boys? The P-38 Lightning was probably one of the good fighters of World War II, two engine.
Oh yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Now,
I completely agree. It was my favourite in Battle of Midway, the computer game as well.
Am I right in thinking that was the aircraft that went supersonic in a dive and then you lost control?
No, you're probably thinking of the.
I'm sure they used to lose. If it isn't a dive, the.
You're thinking of the thud. The P38. No, not P38.
P47.
The Thunderbolt.
What? Yeah, that thing used to go into that. There's some brilliant books. There's a one of the first books I remember reading on aviation was Tumult in the Clouds by James Goodson, and he flew Spitfires on Eagle squadrons before America joined the war, and then ended up on P-47s and P-51s. And some of his stories about the Thunderbolt are just flipping amazing. And actually, Parker was there when. We parked next to one at Goodwood, the Goodwood Revival one year.
Yeah.
We all brought in a couple of Spitfires. And this Thunderbolt there, and it's massive. It is a huge aeroplane. And
yes,
you know, definitely.
I've got it as my 40s. Well, I've got a few for the 40s. But yeah, I started because the brief was the 20s, 30s, 40s, etc. I didn't know how far we went up. So I sort of started in the 20s with the. In fact, you know what, JB, is when you and I were wandering around Hendon when we did our first podcast, yep. and you were asking that same question, which would you like to fly? Talking about flying the Spitfire again. And I said, you know what, actually, I'd much prefer to fly that one down there. It's a Bristol Bulldog.
I've got that, mate. That's what I've got for the 20s.
Yeah, so I mean, I just think it is the most beautiful aeroplane, beautiful biplane. It's got a fixed undercarriage, but it's got a big, it's a Bristol Jupiter piston engine, radial engine, 440 horsepower is what it produced, and it just looks like it would be a beautiful aeroplane to fly. And when you think in the 20s, it's doing 155 knots on it, nearly 180 miles an hour. It's got guns and bombs, so pretty swept up for its time, and just a lovely looking machine.
Now, boys,
I think Douglas Bader was flying one of those when he had his crash.
Yeah, it was a Bulldog, and he was doing unbelievably
low aerobatics in it because he was good, and he just didn't push enough when he was inverted and clipped the wing. But I mean,
and where did he crash?
I'll Google that. I reckon it was somewhere Northolt Way or somewhere.
That was in Goodwood, wasn't it?
I'm on it.
Oh no, so, it's just near there, just down on the south coast.
So
it was Kenley, wasn't it?
Oh, I didn't think it was.
I just see Northolt Kenley. That's what I was thinking. Let me discover. You talk about
now. Whilst,
talk about another aircraft.
So it was the Bader Link that I think it's a great looking aeroplane as well. And it was the Bader Link that made me choose it, because I grew up a mile away from Kenley Airfield, and seeing Reach for the Sky, which they filmed at Kenley in the '60s, was just it was one of the things that got me interested. And when you think exactly what you were talking about there, Parky, they were doing a three-ship formation display at the time, and he was just out mucking about doing his aerobatics at 1 foot and screwed it and, lost his legs. And that was in December 31. It was that long before the war actually started.
Yeah, that's absolutely December 31. Doesn't say where, though.
So, gents, just whilst Parky is Googling things, I just want to revisit this. P-38s, just so you know, during dives, it would shake violently. It was called the Mark Tuck. Don't know if you've heard of that. It'd go into a high-speed compression stall, and the controls would lock up, leaving the pilot no option but to bail out.
Yeah, it's called compressibility. And so at that time, they hadn't worked out, you know, the problems with aerodynamics as they approach the speed of sound. And you get this phenomenon called compressibility. And because the aircraft weren't designed to, and the aerofoils, the wing sections weren't designed to be able to cope with it, it would mean that the controls would then be, these shock waves would then interfere with the controls and make the aircraft, as you said, uncontrollable. So it was a long time. A lot of people lost their lives at this, in this stage of flight, in this sort of just pre-Mach 1 subsonic speed range, and the aircraft would break up or they couldn't control them. And again, I think Eric Winkle-Brown talked about that in his book. Well, many people have, in fact, but perhaps it's something we can look a little bit closer at, because I think I spoke to Eric about it, and I think I've got a bit of audio of him talking about that very thing. I'll try and dig it out for our next podcast.
Excellent.
Yeah, I remember there's he flies a jet that a mate had died in, so it had just broken up and they had no idea why. So he flew exactly the same profile and at about, you know, transonic, so, you know, 0.85, 0.9, not quite supersonic. This thing just goes into a weird oscillations, you know, plus 4G, minus 4, and he's going to lose it, and he manages just to ease it out, throttle back, and he discovers why the aircraft crashed. You know, there was an aerodynamic problem with it. But he was extraordinary, wasn't it?
I'll cancel the I won't get that for next week. Barkey's just
that's the taste of that. It was brilliant.
He's ruined it. He's got it. Hunchlock.
Much better, but pretty much, you know, Barkey's paraphrase.
That's because he was Googling. He can't listen and Google at the same time.
I can. I've got the answer.
Reading Aero Club.
Mate, I could see you couldn't fly and talk on the radio at the same time as well. You used to go into a steep
dive.
I've
got so much better. So here we go. He crashed at Woodley Aerodrome near Reading.
Yeah.
In Bristol Bulldog.
So we all got that wrong.
Yeah. Well, apart from the Bulldog bit.
Yeah. So that was the 20s. Did you get anything for the 30s?
Yeah, sure I did. So again, for me, it's just an aircraft that I've always just thought it's a beautiful looking aeroplane, and it's the Hawker Fury. So another biplane, but, you know, almost the
that's essentially a Hurricane with two wings, right?
Yeah, correct. I was just going to say, as effectively it seems, you know, when you look at it, it's the forerunner to the Hurricane, and you can see the lineage in there. But again, I just think it's a beautiful looking aeroplane.
Would you say the 30s was an era which produced maybe the worst aircraft of all time, though? Just to counter that. I mean, if you look at what they started World War II with and what they ended World War II with.
I mean, it was just development was so unbelievably quick at that time, JB. I mean, when the Hurricane and Spit were first flying, so end of 35, beginning of 36, the RAF was still taking delivery of Gladiators, brand new biplanes.
I chose the Gladiator as my aeroplane from that era. And again, because there was a linkage with Kenley, I think, you know, that, and they were flying in Kenley up until the beginning of the war, exactly as you said. But I did come across, I'd not heard of him before. Have you heard of the South African pilot, Pat Patel, at all?
He wasn't based out of Malta by any chance, was he?
He was. Flipping heck, JB, you're on the money tonight. Are you Googling this?
No, I'll tell you why. Because the Gladiator, for me, there's one story. I think they had like three Gladiators out of Malta, which flew heroically against the Luftwaffe, against all odds. And that's just why it came to mind.
Yeah, faith, hope, charity, and desperation.
Is that what they're called?
The Falklands jets are named Faith, Hope, Charity after the yeah, the Malta ones. Oh. And then the Spitz reinforced them.
But this guy, he was killed in 41. He had 16 air-to-air kills in a Gladiator.
That's quite impressive.
During the war in that region. Then he switched to Hurricane. He ended up getting he ace in a day. He got 5 kills in one day flying the Hurricane.
Wow.
That's
amazing, isn't it? Here's a really stupid question for you, but... why did the biplane die out? Why do two wings not work?
Too slow.
There's a lot of drag.
Too much drag. Although they did have a Hurricane where they designed a Hurricane. I don't know if you boys have ever seen it. That was designed to go off a carrier. That was a biplane to get the lift. Okay, because the drag isn't too, so much of a penalty at lower speeds. So it gets the lift of the biplane, then would jettison the top wing. I mean, they've got some wacky ideas. It's pretty cool.
Well, can you imagine doing that testing for the wing release?
It was probably Winkle Brown again, wasn't it?
Oh, it's just the tail off again.
I'll tell you the weirdest thing which I've ever seen, ever. And it's kind of in relation to that. Have you ever seen the rubber landing decks?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah. I think Winkle did that as well. He pretty much did everything, didn't he, that fella?
I think, you know, after about three pints in the pub, that sounds like a brilliant idea, doesn't it?
Yeah. We'll make a deck completely out of rubber.
It wouldn't hurt then. You could do a vertical landing off hot shots.
Yeah, wonderful. Have you seen the footage of them landing on?
Yeah, it's insane.
It's just phenomenal. You'd need your gum shield in, I think.
What did you go 40s then, Dunk? Come on. Davey's turning this off if he goes Spitfire or Hurricane.
No. I've got three. There's so many in the 40s. That's the thing. So am I allowed three? I've put three, but there's so many. But I first of all, you know, to me, the Mustang has always been, you know, just P-51 Mustang, most phenomenal looking aeroplane. And it was a war winner as well, you know, along with the Mosquito, the Spitfire, the Hurricane. So that's always been there. And I would love to fly one of those. Equally, again, watching quite a lot of the footage over the weekend with it being the RAF 100. Again, we go back to Winkle Brown and what he did. He was lucky enough to fly both the British and the German aircraft, and I would love to fly an FW-190. I mean, I think that is just, again, an incredible, the performance of it, and I think it looks right as well as a fighter. It looks mean. It looks hard. You know, it says, don't mess with me. And so I think, you know, that would certainly be up there. And the third was actually the one that you guys have mentioned already, the Thunderbolt, because the people that it's not something I think that you naturally look at and go, wow, that's a beautiful looking aeroplane. But everyone that I've spoken to says that aeroplane is phenomenal. It's, you know, it's fast, it's maneuverable, it's nice to land, it's nice. It's just as an all-rounder, a fantastic aeroplane. So I've taken the liberty of having three. I hope you don't mind.
Well, so I went for the FW-190's Nemesis in the Hawker Tempest.
I love that aircraft.
You know, when we were... And it was because, again, I was reminded of it down in Hendon when we were down there. And it just looks like a mean aeroplane. And I think I mentioned it on one of the... maybe on one of the earlier podcasts, but... Pierre Klosterman's book, The Big Show, where he fires typhoons and then tempests, and his low-level missions out over Germany and Belgium and that area post-D-Day in these things. It's just unbelievable. What are you got? I'm going to have to reread that book again now.
Well, I think for those listening... If there's people listening, I read that book recently as well by Pierre Klosterman. It's called The Big Show. If you want a just jaw-dropping read about the heroism of those guys as the Allied forces pushed through Germany, the losses were just phenomenal. The way that he writes it, the emotion he writes it with, is just it's spellbinding. So you know, if you're short of a book to read, then look that up.
Good knowledge.
It's one of those. He's got his. I think Le Grand Charles is his aircraft, and it's beautifully written. And at the end, when he says goodbye to, you know, this aircraft that's kept him alive on so many trips, he just goes up, plays with some class for a bit, lands, never sees it again, and it's moving. It really is. It's an amazing book.
Yeah, and you know, when they're running out of gas, dodging AAA, some hefty AAA as well in the weather, and Fog Wolf 190s turn up. Just amazing, isn't it? The stuff. Definitely, we ought to do pilot episodes book club. We'll sort that for a different.
My spoiler on that one is, can you remember there's a chapter and they basically work out at the end that it's Hitler's private airfield where they've got some Heinkel refuel to maybe try, and it's right at the end of the war, maybe try to get into South America or something like that. But essentially, they're just tasked to strafe some Arado, some jets that are on this airfield, and eight of them come out the sun and do one sweep across the airfield in sort of a massive line abreast. Yeah. And he takes out a line of jets and they pull out at the end of it and two of them are left. Six have been shot down in about 5 seconds. And it's just, you know, you're there with him. It's unbelievable stuff they were doing.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Bloody hell.
Oh, I'm reading that again.
Yeah. It's worth a read, JB. Amazing.
Yeah. I'm all over it. You made me lose track now. Where are we up to?
That was 40s.
It's 40s. Have you?
Yeah, well, I was going to go Typhoon, actually, which is the, essentially the Tempest Typhoon. They were so close. I think the Tempest had a more reinforced tail, didn't it, than the Typhoon? But essentially it was a 24-litre. It was a massive aircraft compared to the Mustang Spitfire. It was probably, do you reckon, bigger than a Thunderbolt? I don't know. Certainly similar.
Yeah.
Big aircraft.
Well, Thunderbolt's sort of stockier and sat higher, whereas a Tempest and a Typhoon are just overall big aeroplanes, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. But just awesome speed. And, we always said the Mark 19 was, Spitfire was about the quickest, propelled aircraft. And I think with the Typhoon, the Tempest, after that, you need to have a jet to go faster. It's about as quick as you'll get a war machine with a propeller on it.
During the Second World War, during the latter stages of of propeller-driven aircraft, who were the real stars here? The guys who were designing the airframes or the guys designing the engines? Because it always seems to correlate with the same engines.
That's a good question.
Probably a bit of both, really. You need an airframe, don't you, that can fly fast, and you need the power to make it. It's without either of them, you're stuffed. So I guess they went hand in hand, didn't they? Engine performance and
they had to be designed together, because the bigger the look at the Mark 19 Spitfire, you put that against a Mark 1 Spitfire in the hangar, the thing's about, maybe Dunk knows the exact figure or Parky, but it's about 10 foot longer, if not more, because you've got so much more weight on the front, because the engine is so much bigger, the Griffin engine compared to the Merlin, that it's subsequently the whole aeroplane is bigger down the back end. So you couldn't, I don't think you could just independently design an aeroplane and then put
didn't they retrofit the Mustang from Allison engines to Rolls-Royce engines?
Yes.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. But equally, you look at there's little subtle redesigns in that as well. The British version initially didn't have the bubble canopy. It had, it was almost hurricane-esque, I guess, in the canopy that it had. They went on at that point to these sleeve valve engines that.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Produced a huge amount of power. And the Thunderbolt, I don't know if the Thunderbolt was a sleeve valve engine, but... Big radial engine, yeah. But the Tempest, certainly, with this... flipping Napier Sabre, it was called, in it, and it was producing nearly 2,200 horsepower. It did 432 miles an hour, this thing. I mean, it's jet-like performance, really. And as Parky said, you couldn't really go any faster with a propeller aeroplane.
Are any of these bigger aircraft, the later aircraft, still in existence, flying with anyone?
Well, we, when Goddard and I, was it when we were at Duxford and we looked at the there's a plan to try and get a Typhoon flying. You know, it's quite, it's at its early stage, but they've, they kind of know the airframe and they know the engine. The engine was there, this beast of a, you know, as Dunk says, 24 cylinder engine. But
was it a Napier or a Napier or a Sabre engine or something like that?
A Napier Sabre is what it was called. Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
But you're right, JB. There's a you know, just think of there's so many types of aircraft that were built in the war, and there's just so few flying. You know, the vast majority, there aren't any airworthy examples.
Yeah. I do wonder if like 3D printing will sort that out at some point, because of course, you know, the problem is spare parts.
Print yourself a Thunderbolt off.
No, but you could. But you could.
Thank
print
you for a trip,
a, but you could print a part.
You've that, stunned
that,
us.
That'd stop you having to dig them up at that point.
Were it perhaps?
50s. Go right, on. I'm going to go with this one. I went, and we've talked about this aeroplane before on the podcast, but I went with the English Electric Lightning.
Marvellous aircraft. Marvellous.
And we've seen the first RAF Mach 2. Well, I don't know when it was, 1959, when it first flew. But you're just strapping yourself to a rocket. I think we said before, don't you mention the guys, you know, low level over the sea, looking down the radar boot, as they called it, doing the intercepts on a pulse radar. But actually just getting in the bloody thing and going flying in the first place on strapping yourself to two rockets and a bunch of fuel, just amazing. Especially at that time. You think 1959, well, you're only 30 years on from the SPAD at that point, and yet you're going back to...
That's a good point, actually.
And they said that, I mean, I don't know, you know, Parky can probably remember back this far, but it was said that, you know, if they were going off and doing an intercept and they just engaged the burners and then, you know, blasted up to, you know, 40, 50,000 feet, whatever they could get up to, and then they'd almost glide back, and it was a 20-minute. You didn't have any more fuel than 20 minutes, because but the performance of the thing was just eye-watering.
So how do they actually operate them? I'm guessing air-to-air refueling was vital for these things.
Yeah, I think they could. Eventually, they ended up with some over-wing fuel tanks. Do you remember those? It looked a bit weird.
And on the belly as well.
A big belly tank as well.
Yeah, yeah. And exactly that. Then they put more fuel internally, I'm fairly sure. I mean, I remember being in a Phantom and doing a scramble. So we're, you know, this is late 80s and we're getting airborne to intercept two Russian Bear aircraft that are coming down sort of Iceland way. And I was like Lucas on Phantoms at the time. And, you know, we were going to scramble. We used to scramble loads back in those days. But the controller said, no, it's the Lightning's last ever scramble. So he got airborne from Binbrook and got the tanker. And we almost sort of sat on the ground and you knew he was airborne. But he was so, you always had to stay within some sort of diversion so you could go to Iceland or Norway or, I guess, northern Scotland. But because he was right in the middle, the Lightning couldn't leave the tanker, essentially. So we then scrambled, and I can just remember being plugged in to this Victor and looking over. I was on the left wing, and on the right wing, there was this Lightning. And it's like Goddard says, it's just a cool jet. You know, it was old, but it had something about it that meant business. Other than it had a lack of fuel.
Yeah. Now, I find this interception business very, very interesting. What is the point? I mean, obviously the point is, you know, to stop Russians attacking UK airspace, I guess. But they're not actually going to do that. So why are you continually going up there? Just to prove you can do it?
Well, I mean, you're mainly policing them.
Turn that round, JB. What happens if you don't?
Well, I mean, if they attack, they attack. I mean, you've probably got much more to worry about than a bear bomber.
I mean, the way I looked at it, JB, is that, I mean, you're actually just policing your airspace. So if you jump on an airliner and fly, I don't know, from Durham Tees to Denmark, you're just going to go out across the North Sea and you're going to be speaking to air traffic controllers. And these aircraft will just fly straight through the airways. So they shouldn't be there. You know, there's rules and there's controlled airspace. That's how airliners fly around. And these boys are just floating around, speaking to nobody. So they need to be policed, you know, and what are they up to? And, you know, we've had instances where they've gone pretty close to the UK mainland. You know, that's obviously us. And I think Norway gets bored of intercepting the Russians up there, you know, but they just, you know, we just fly on their wing and see what they're doing.
So, and what's the interaction like when you get up there? Can you talk to them on the radio? Do you wave at them? What do you do?
No, I mean, there would be a common frequency you could transmit on. But yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, back in the old days, they used to slave the radar gun turrets essentially onto you. And if you dropped in behind them, they were taught they'd, some of the Bear Foxtrots, they were the more naval ones, they'd throw sonar buoys, try and, you know, literally make you collect one if you were sort of underneath them. But, you know, I remember my first ever scramble, and you're getting nice and close, so you're looking at this Russian who's in this, and you could hear the supersonic blades on the engine. So that's the first time I've ever heard an aircraft in a jet on its wing. That's unusual. You could hear this sort of this drone, and you're wearing a helmet, and the Phantom was really noisy anyway. And I'd hear this thing, and then you'd go up really close. And I remember the first time seeing in the tail this Russian guy, and he showed me that he had a can of Coke.
I heard a good story once that a proper Cold War early 80s intercept, and somebody did exactly that, Parky, pulled up really close to have a look. And the guy in the back was holding up a copy of the Lucas Station magazine.
Really?
That's good.
Excellent.
That's some good intel. But so yeah, so Lightning in the 50s. Dunk, any other 50s aeroplanes there?
Mine was Lightning as well. Like, you know, this for me that was the one. So we're on the same page there, Goddess.
Well, I've got one, which, and this was my interesting stat when I showed some boys around the Lank. And when we flew the Vulcan with the Lancaster, and get this, JB, so the Lancaster, you know, he got his four engines and then flew in 1941, first flight. When do you reckon the Vulcan, so big Delta wing, could fly to Russia and back up, you know, at 50-odd thousand feet, incredibly performing aircraft. Lancaster was in 1941. When do you reckon the Vulcan flew?
I reckon the Vulcan went about 1948.
52.
Oh, really?
But 11 years different.
That's taking the wind out yourself.
Yeah. Sorry.
I thought you were going to go at least mid-60s.
No,
JB.
I'm a huge...
2004.
I'm relatively
two
big.
2 years later? No, JB, no, it was 11.
Sorry, 1986.
Yeah, they were really slow in developing in the late 40s.
But all those three aircraft, the Vulcan, the Victor and the Valiant, they were developed in incredibly fast time. I mean, if you look at like how we develop aircraft now, those things were flying within, what, five years of specification? It's incredible.
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah. It extraordinary times, I think. You know, the Lightning and the Vulcan, that was just bizarre, cutting edge, you know. And if you do compare 10 years earlier, what was flying, and then even 10 years before that, you know, you went biplane to Mustang to Lightning. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard one of the good stories I heard about the Vulcan, and I do think this one is true, but they had, they were on quick reaction alert, the nuclear QRA back in the, I guess, 60s. And when they'd scramble, the crew would go running out there. And apparently, because this, you know, whether it was nuclear armed or not, this particular one, but they used to padlock shut the crew hatch underneath. So the first thing the ground crew would do would run out there, open the padlock, and there was apparently a set of four buttons underneath that you could press. Quite a lot of aeroplanes have some sort of quick start capability, but you could press these four buttons and it'd start those four massive Olympus Concorde engines spooling up. And this crew ran out when the hooter goes, clearly a practice. But they get there, no one's got the bloody key for the padlock, and someone's already started the engine. So they're all stood there, crossed arms, while someone has to run back and go and get a set of bolt cutters to let them into their own aeroplane that's sat on the pan running.
Amazing.
It's just typically British. Who's got the key?
Now, don't give
it to me.
You were saying that you've got quite a lot of audio of veterans. Have you got any audio of V bomber crews?
No, I haven't actually. I mean, it's something perhaps that, you know, it's certainly coming more to the forefront. I mean, a lot of the interviews that we've been watching over the last few days for RAF 100 have been with Martin Withers, who we know. And so, you know, perhaps Martin would come on and have a chat with us at some point. That'd be fascinating, wouldn't it?
I was sat with him on at that RAF 100 gala on Saturday.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a good guy. And of course, lots of great stories about those Cold War days would come from Martin, I think. So, well, we'll have to see if we can get him along. We keep promising guests, don't we? And then we don't manage to pull one out of the bag.
We'll do it.
We're establishing ourselves. We've got to run out of stuff to say, and then we'll get the guests on.
Exactly.
So, first guest about 3 or 4 years' time.
Now, it was Martin with the Falklands raid as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he was.
Yes,
Martin must be an awesome story to hear. I'd love to hear that one.
Yeah.
Have you read that, Vulcan 607?
I can't remember the exact letters, but yeah. It's the black. Yeah.
The coolest pictures from that raid are looking at all the aircraft lined up on Ascension. It looks seriously cool.
Yeah. Extraordinary.
I've actually got one. I don't think either of them really qualify, because one isn't a fighter, and I think, well, one isn't a fighter. Neither of them are in the RAF, and one might have even been developed in the 40s. But
so that's close.
Yeah. So the Sea Vixen, I think that looked really, really cool. Not sure how good it was. It just looked pretty cool. And the other one, which will probably amaze you, and I just love kind of how it just looks like it's been thrown together. Probably the ugliest aircraft ever to fly, but that's where its beauty lies, is the Fairey Gannet.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Gannet, yeah.
It's such a cool aircraft.
Isn't that a Monty Python sketch as well? Oh, the Gannet.
I've got no idea.
The X-Men version.
Two Navy aircraft there you picked, JB. So we're not going to say much.
No.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of an honourable mention for the Fairey Swordfish earlier in the 30s. But I'm not. Did we? I don't even know whether we flew that in the RAF.
No. No, Navy only.
Royal Navy, sir.
All right, we'll stay away from that one then. 60s. Any guesses what I went for in the 60s?
Yeah, I can guess.
Hang on.
Well, the thing is,
Harrier.
No. Well, not for me. I'm not going to say Goddard's is Harrier. I'm going to go. I think that it's going to be along similar lines to me. But the thing is, God has asked for fighters. You see, and my idea is not a fighter.
Oh.
But I've got to put it in there. I've got to put it in there.
What did you go with?
I went with the SR-71.
Oh, good shout. But Clay doesn't.
It doesn't have to be RAF, does it? You started with a French.
Continuum of the RAF. It's traditional. Yeah,
well, well,
with the RAF. We had exchange officers doing it. Oh, that's a belter.
Now, do you mean the SR-71 or do you mean the A-12?
No, I know. I mean the SR-71.
All right, and I just wanted to—is
that you and your conspiracy theories, JB?
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, no, that's him on that's him on Wikipedia. No, SR-71. So I've written the book
Skunk Works I can't remember his name now. Skunk Works, brilliant book.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I was going to say, Goddess. I read that book about that was innovation is a word that gets thrown around an awful lot at the moment. And I think it sort of takes away from it. But I certainly think that the Skunk Works, the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works back in the day must have been the most phenomenal place. And they came up with these ideas. But the aeroplane itself, it just looks right. Anything that flies Mach 3 plus, you know, has got to go into our favourites, whether it was Air Force or not, boys.
Yeah, that's a good shout. I actually went with F4 for a couple of reasons, mainly because my friend Big Tone.
I love you, Goddess.
When I went through Valley, there were a bunch of F4 guys that were coming through there, and some of their stories were brilliant for a young, I was 19, 20 at the time coming through. I remember one of the guys, Doc Watson, talking about the time he ejected as they were doing a high alpha demo next to the tanker. So I guess he just filled up the jet. And there was something to do with reverse wing flow. And you could see the fuel vapor spiraling the wrong way up the wing.
Yeah, you could put the dump on or something, I think. And
And Doc's instructor was demoing this from the boot of a two-seater, and they lost control.
Good ended demo.
Ejecting out of this thing. And Doc telling me, because he was only a youngster at the time, watching this jet spiral into the sea just below them and make a God almighty splash and thinking, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. There was one of the other boys. Who was it? I'll think of his name in a minute. But he'd had an airspeed indicator failure in an F4 and ended up landing it, but landing it too fast. And it shows how powerful this aeroplane is. He put the hook down and took the approach end cable because he knew he was landing above approach speed. It ripped the cable out of the ground. And he only just stopped at the overrun cable on the far end of the airfield as well. And then subsequently, again, when I did my F-16 training out in the US, the guys who did ground school for us out there were all retired USAF pilots. And most of them had flown the F-4, and most of them had flown the F-4 in combat in Vietnam. And on a break from learning about the F-16, you go into the crew room, you sit there with a cup of coffee and just listen to these boys dit on about their experiences in Thailand, Vietnam. One of the guys had a guy called Bob Harcrow, had 2,000 hours F-4, 1,800 of which were combat hours, and 2,000 hours Eagle. He was first carder on the Eagle as well. You just listen to these guys for hours and hours and hours. And when you think, we're still flying, so 59, 60, the first prototype flew.
Yeah.
And I think it's the Greeks are still flying it now, isn't it? Is the Hellenic Air Force still flying
it?
Yeah, there's a few kicking around, a few Air Forces still. I think we got ours in 68 because they were modded with the Rolls-Royce engine,
Now, never did anything for me, Phantom.
Oh. and when I picked up my first brochure to join, the officer and aircrew one had a picture of an F-4 with a pilot and a nav on the front of it.
Yeah,
it looked
Now, there is
can I just quickly... Now, this sounds... But I promise I was going to say this anyway. It's a little bit naff.
Ooh.
But I was going to pick the Harrier because this is 60s. And I remember doing CHIV and just the early Harriers, the GR3s, a couple of them sort of came in and I just remember seeing these jets and just the concept of... at the time, I was naive. I'd called it a fighter, but clearly it wasn't. But of a fast jet, again, I was naive. It wasn't very fast. But essentially, being able to land vertically was ridiculously cool. And just the technology and the whole point of, you know, how the boys would operate that thing off fields. Did you boys, I guess you must have done a fair few takeoffs on grass.
Yeah.
I mean, that is stuff, you know, my experience of flying, I've done brilliant, but that is mental, really, thinking of it. And I seem to recall some boys talking about some squadron scramble in the field, and they all kind of just went off in line abreast, about 10 of them.
Yeah, you know, it's just
ridiculously good flying.
There was a brilliant picture in the sim. I can't remember whose it was, but yeah, one of the sim instructors there, it was a really top mate and quietly spoken. And there was this picture just stuck on the wall. And it was, I think, 12 Harriers all taking off line abreast. And there was one out the front. And so you think, naturally, that was the boss, Neggers. That was the junior pilot who got into massive trouble later because he was supposed to let the boss go first, and he jumped the gun. So off he went. And 11 other Harriers sort of followed behind as this JP launched off in the field. But, yeah, I mean, there were some incredible operating stories.
But as a jet dunk, that is... pretty exceptional. We talk about all the other aircraft, but just the versatility, you know, being able to do that, being able to land in a field, it's outrageous, really.
Yeah.
Did you ever used to worry about, like...
Go on, JB.
Did you ever used to worry about, like, sticks and bits of debris from fields? Because like, don't isn't that lethal for a jet?
Yeah, it can be, but they would try and, you know, they would clear an area. So you wouldn't just land on the grass vertically. It couldn't do that because the power of the engine would just dig a big hole and you'd just keep going down until you reach the center of the earth and then you'd melt. So they had to put down things they called Mexi pads, so metal pads that they pinned into the ground with sort of 10-foot stakes. I mean, huge, big things, because the power of the
engine... Say huge, big things. That was the tiniest postage stamp you've ever landed on when you were doing it in the middle of a field.
Yeah, sure. So, but no, I don't mean the size of the metal pad. I mean the size of the pins that pinned it down to stop it being blown away when you were, you know, when you were hovering over it. But yeah, they were tiny. What were they? I can't remember. Were they 60 by 60? It sounds massive, but it really wasn't.
Yeah, 60 it's not by 60. When you hover over it and you can't see anything.
Yeah, that was 60 inches.
Yeah.
Yeah. So but the first time, one of the early trips on the Harrier conversion unit you do is once you've got a few vertical landings under your belt, you go and land in this place called Vigo Wood at the end of the runway at Wittering, which was enclosed on three sides by a wood. And it was this pad that you'd come in, hover, and then land. And I watched, you know, my course definitely, but anytime any of us landed, there were half massive tree limbs lying around the place. Yeah. And then the first time we landed on grass, I could not believe I was taking off of grass on a multi-million pound aeroplane and then landing on it where you're bouncing around full off-roading. And I remember afterwards, the ground crew, you remember there was a set of doors behind the main wheels, Dunk? Mm. I remember the guy opened up the doors and essentially a bale of hay fell out where all burnt grass had collected on land.
So what's the actual... So how's it actually work then? Do you have some ground crew lads, some RAF regiment or someone run out to a field, put down a little postage stamp thing, stake it in, and then you show up?
Yeah, essentially that was Royal Engineers who used to do that. So we'd have detachments of Royal Engineers who would sort out the field sites, and then you'd fly the Harriers in. And it was there. We'd have Royal Engineer detachments as well to fill in holes on runways and main operating bases. And it was as simple as that. And that Mexi material had been around for a long time, and it used to weren't allowed to land on a little strip of Mexi runway. I did hear. Do you remember Gibbo, Dunk? When they moved the jets from Gutterslow to Larbrook, he didn't know you weren't allowed to do that, and did this rolling vertical landing on this what was a takeoff strip. As he landed, this bow wave started in front of him, so he ended up surfing this thing along, you know, and these big massive pins Dunk was talking about flying out the sides.
I know, Park, it's your choice as well, and we're sort of stealing it from you a little, but to be honest, you know, landing it on the ship as well was is quite something, you know, to land that aeroplane on the ship.
Do you boys know, do you know him personally, the guy who landed his Harrier on a container ship?
Who was that? I think, was
is
he?
That not Sharky Ward?
I don't know.
In fact, wasn't it Rob Schwab?
It could have been.
I'm Googling again.
Yeah. Some research. But that was one with the Spanish claim salvage rights.
That's the one. Yeah. It is. Now, from your experience with Harriers, how daunting would that have been for him?
Yeah, he had nowhere else to go.
Yeah, it'd be pretty daunting. His name was Ian Soapy Watson.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, that would have been pretty daunting. So again, just going back to the aircraft carrier itself, you know, you have effectively six spots on the aircraft carrier to land on, and each of those, again, they, you know, that when you're standing on them, they look relatively big. But even the aircraft carrier, when you come back to it after you've launched off it for the first time, or you're arriving to the aircraft carrier for the first time, given I suppose it's only 600 feet long, our aircraft carrier, they called it a through deck cruiser, not an aircraft carrier. It wasn't big enough apparently, and it was just, it was like a little speedboat. It was like, flipping heck, have I got to land on that? And the first time I did land on it, I nearly bounced off the side as well. So that was quite exciting. It didn't quite shut the throttle in time, and it bounced back up in the air, landed on one outrigger, and then came to rest about 3 inches from the side of the ship. It wasn't my finest landing.
the best one I ever saw was... Oh, Park is just showing us a picture of a Harrier GR3.
Oh,
that's it. That is the landing on the ship.
That's the landing on the ship. My God. I thought you got it bang on top of the... I thought that was my landing, Parky. I thought you got it bang on top of the container. I didn't realise.
Oh, no, it was Stella Light. It was that Sea Harrier with the Soapy Watson put
now,
on there.
I just mentioned it from the pilot's point of view. Imagine it from the crew's point of view.
Yeah, they wouldn't know he was coming, would they?
No idea. And he just lands. There you go.
He sort of messed up that truck, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. He's put a dent in it.
That's unbelievable.
One of the best videos I've ever seen was Bradders. He's a guy still in the RAF now. It's his head-up display footage of landing on Illustrious or Invincible on the only spot that's left. And... you could not reverse park a car in the space that he lands this thing in. It is absolutely nose to tail on that ship. And when you speak to Bradders about it, he was definitely a little worried on this particular one. Oh. It is flipping brilliant.
So Parky's always giving you a bit of banter about how slow the Harrier is. Obviously, speed is important for a fighter aircraft. How capable or how useful was the Sea Harrier as a fighter aircraft?
What a great question.
Difficult to tell, actually, because A, none of us flew it, but if you believe the Navy boys, then actually it was really quite capable. And to be honest, when we flew against it, when we did sort of exercises with it, it did really quite well. It had, was it a Blue Vixen radar?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, Blue Vixen. It was a pretty advanced radar, and it was set up for that particular aeroplane as well. Remember, they were one of the first platforms in the UK to get the AMRAAM as well. Can only carry one or two of them.
I think with the AMRAAM, it was far more capable, wasn't it? And the upgraded radar. Originally, it came out in the Falklands. You know, it was just, we just called it a pulse radar. So it's not looking at velocity, JB. Without getting geeky, it's going to see a lot of the ground and the sea. So a lot of the... the attacks, or they shot down, you know, a lot of Argentinian
20, you know, was it not?
Skyhawks, etc., and Etendards, but they were mainly after the boys had bombed. They couldn't, you know, find them with their radar. So once they knew where they were, because they were over the islands, they were tending to get the kills. Then that's my understanding. Whereas, you know, you could argue that the old Phantom with a pulse Doppler radar, you know, this was, you know. Back in the day, I flew the ex-Navy, you know, Phantoms. They always talked about that was an incredibly potent aircraft as an air defender. So it had real look-down, shoot-down capability, more than those Harriers did in the sort of, you know, late 70s, early 80s at the time. Having said that, you know, it did an awesome job in the Falklands War. So, you know, technology moves on. And I think with the new radar and the AMRAAM, it turned into a good, you know, a potent air defender at the end of it.
Did you ever used to?
Yeah, it was the right aeroplane at the right time, definitely in the Falklands. If you read, there's a couple of books about the Falklands War. There's there's GR3 books about the bombing aspects of it, and there's a couple of Sea Harrier over the Falklands by Sharky Ward, and also I thought a really good book by a guy called Dave Morgan, who I've met a couple of times actually, who got four air to air kills in the Falklands. He was an RAF flight lieutenant on exchange with the Navy. We couldn't have done any of that without the Harrier because of the ability to fly off our ships. And despite any limitations of, you know, they were just sidewinders at the time, weren't they, with that pulse radar, as Big Tone was talking about. they just did an amazing job. And the mix of the two, where you had the GR3s who were very used to bombing, and the Sea Harriers who were able to do the air defence side, there's always a bit of luck that just happened to be their particular time, and you know we could put everything together and get it down to the Falklands. But you know, just an amazing job. And Yeah, go on.
Did you ever used to train against them in the tornado parky?
Yeah, I've done. You know, we used to go and do exercises, and you know, I fought the Sea Harriers in the Phantom. You know, just doing air combat against them, and also the Tornado F3 did a fair bit of Sea Harrier a fill, we'd call it. So you know, either you're full up combat 1v1, or you know, maybe 2v2, 4v4, something like that. So you just do missions against them, and yeah, they were, you know, they were good fights actually. You know, it was. It was fairly, you know, even Stevens, I seem to recall, you know, it was the Phantom, we would take the tanks off so it would be completely clean. So that the performance was pretty good, actually. Then it was a sort of 7G fighter, the Phantom, which is almost, you know, we convinced ourselves. And it's probably true. If you'd actually go to war and you hit the merge, you would jettison the tank. So you would turn your big lumbering three tank Phantom into a lightweight fighter by jetting the tanks. So yeah, that's how we fought them, and that was good. The boys all bang on about it, but they the interesting thing about the Harrier, when you're fighting against it, they would move the nozzles, and I remember seeing that. And you know, the thing could fly ridiculously slowly. Viffing was it called? Where you vector? What was that stand for, boys?
Vectoring in forward flight.
There we go. And, you know, suddenly this Harrier from doing, you know, its top speed of 300 or whatever it was, would be doing about 60. But it was a good fight. Yeah, definitely an interesting one with, you know, with those capabilities.
Excellent. Right. Well, we've been going for about an hour and a quarter now. And I think we're, what, in the 70s or something. So we'll catch up with the rest another time. Do we have any questions this week, Godders?
Yeah, we've got a couple. We've got so one from a guy, Ian Savage, on Twitter. He's got, if the BBMF could obtain another aircraft, what would each of you choose?
No, I bet you'd all choose the same one.
Yeah, tell us that.
It would be the Mosquito, wouldn't it?
Yes, there you go.
Easy.
It's got to be.
Is there still one of those flying somewhere?
They have got them, yeah. I've lost count, but I think there's certainly one. I think there might be two.
I've got a feeling it's in Chester for some reason.
It's not in the UK, so...
build them in New Zealand.
New Zealand, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But there's a real push to try and get one in the UK. But, of course, you know, raising the kind of money that's required for these projects is very difficult indeed. And then getting the correct drawings and getting the jigs made. And there's just the complexity of it is huge.
3D printing, I've told you.
Saying it, oh, yeah.
3D printing,
we'll put it out in a few years' time, it'll be fine. But yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic aeroplane. There's a number of reasons, you know, why as well. Again, I mentioned it earlier, it's a war winner. There's no doubt about it. Fantastic performance, good-looking aeroplane. Again, when you talk about innovation, an aeroplane made of balsa wood, you know, amazing. And just a lovely aeroplane, I'm sure, to fly. Not that I've had the privilege, but equally, you know, for BBMF, because that was the question, it's very difficult because we only have a very small amount of engineers work on that flight. Mm. So you're pretty limited to then the types of engines that you can work with. So suddenly you need to specialize in different engines. That's another huge skill set and would probably require more people to be there on the flight, which of course we don't have that luxury in terms of being able to get as many people as we would want. So the Mosquito would have given us the benefit of actually being powered by Merlin engines, very similar to the ones they already have there. So they might have needed a carpenter to knock up a bit of the woodwork here and there, but apart from that...
Just pull them off a building site.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, get a chippy in. But that would be it.
Excellent.
Yeah, definitely a good shout. All agreed on that one. We've got another question from Sean Doherty. Quite niche, this one. Did Parky assist with the Mayday that the Vulcan declared as shown on the Guy Martin programme?
That was Dunk.
That was me.
Yeah.
That was Dunk. And that was Dunk, it was you.
Yeah, it was. I was actually going through it today, actually, just having a look at that very thing, because I was just thinking about that particular incident. We were displaying. It was... It was myself and Jez Attridge, who was the station commander at Coningsby at the time. We'd gone up to Prestwick to do... So there was an international air show that was always run at Lucas. And I believe that was the only international air show in Scotland at the time. And in 2013, they had the last one of those because Lucas was shutting down. So they then decided they would do their own international air show, and they put it on the seafront to air. And so Prestwick was the closest base, and they based all the aeroplanes out of it. So we went up there to go and do that display. Cut a long story short, we took off, we did the display. The weather was beautiful, actually. And just before us, there was a Saab Draken displaying. Oh. I know, it was just a cool aeroplane to look at. So we were holding crowd rear, watching this Draken, roting up and down the Scottish coastline there. And as we came off the display, we were supposed to then transit directly across past Macrahanish and then go over to Ireland to do a display at Port Rush. So we're both supposed to transit over there. But as I left the display frequency, the director on the ground said, could you please go and give the Vulcan a hand? He's having some problems with his undercarriage. So I sent Jez off to do the show over at Port Rush on his own, and I went off to go and find the Vulcan, who, of course, he had this problem, and his thought process was, the Swedish guy was there, he was in a jet, but he didn't know, how that aeroplane performed and if there was a language problem. The radios and all of those aircraft are not great. So, he'd thought all of that through and thought, actually, the pilot of it was a guy called Phil O'Dell, who's the chief test pilot for Rolls-Royce, and he knew it was me displaying, so we'd worked together before. So he said can Dunk come and have a look and see? So I then spent the next 10 minutes in close formation on the Vulcan, having a look at what was wrong with the undercarriage and translating that across to the crew in the aircraft. And they tried yawing the aircraft left and right, and they were going through their checklist as they would.
Did you land on the top and get out and have a look?
I did. I landed. Yeah, I did. It's quite tricky to climb past that big intake to get underneath, but with the right ropes and carabiners, I managed. But no, I what I did do is they were just about to put the gear up, and it was stuck at the nose gear was stuck at a 45 degree angle, jammed, and they were just about to put it up, and I said, "Well, just wait. I'll move underneath and have a look to see if there's anything obvious jamming it." So I did feel like, which Thunderbird was it that got, taken up into the belly of the bigger Thunderbird? It
Thunderbird
was
2.
Ludicrous. Sorry,
Thunderbird 2.
Thunderbird 2, yeah, exactly. So under
Virgil.
The massive Vulcan I went, looking directly up into the nose wheel bay, and had a little sneaky peek underneath to see if there was nothing there. And anyway, so thankfully he then they then moved the gear, nothing graunched and grinded, and it actually went down correctly. And I then landed, and then, of course, he was still worried it might collapse. So they landed this huge aircraft and effectively did a massive wheelie down the runway to get it as slow as possible in case when they put the nose down, it collapsed. But thankfully it didn't. And
that was at Coningsby, wasn't it?
No, that was up at Prestwick.
Oh, did I land it up there? Because there was another time, there was one a few years before that, actually, where the Vulcan had had a gear snag, declared a mayday, and landed back in a Coningsby. Because you remember, it was in the 29 Squadron hangar.
Yeah, I think that was a hydraulic failure, wasn't it?
So yeah.
So what was the issue with the Vulcan that you were helping out?
It was undoubtedly a hydraulic problem of some sort. But who knows? I didn't find out subsequently exactly what was wrong. It then stayed on the ground for a number of days, and we, of course, took off and went our merry way. But I expect it was a hydraulic problem of some sort.
Excellent. Good.
Right, final question there. This one's from Catherine Rhodes, who is a magician, actually. Met her a couple of times at various things, and part of the magic circle. She hasn't told me how they do it, but we'll get round to that, I'm sure. But her question is a good one to finish on. A bit of crew room banter. What's your favourite biscuit?
Ooh, blimey, that's a difficult question. Favorite?
I answered her on Twitter. I couldn't hold it back. I went with chocolate hobnobs.
Oh, I don't know about that, Goddess. What, dark chocolate or milk chocolate?
Oh, I'll go milk chocolate.
Really? Oh, dear, let yourself down there.
Mason never eats biscuits or chocolate. His body's a temple, you see.
Unless it's hyperglycemic.
In a wanna.
Well, JB, you can answer this one. What are you going with?
Is it Jaffa Cake a biscuit?
Yeah. Well, or is it a cake? Isn't there a comedian sketch about this?
I don't know. But I go with Jaffa Cake. A Jaffa Cake is...
Yeah, have you got one of those, you know, the 12-yard ones? It's like instead of a yard of ale, you do a yard of Jaffa Cakes at Christmas.
Not happening. just to elaborate on that, just very, 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 very quickly, what do you put in your packed lunches when you go flying? Do you get issued with it, or do you have to buy it?
That used to be the funny thing. When we do transatlantic stuff, we'd stop at the Azores. they'd end up giving you stuff that really wasn't compatible with a fast jet cockpit, like some spreadable cheese and a knife.
A pot noodle.
Have you ever eaten a dry pot noodle? Oh, my God.
They're generally sandwiches, JB.
What's your biscuit, though, Parky?
I don't know. I'm still...
Come on.
Big tone.
I did say to Catherine on Twitter, I considered Garibaldi, but the little
one.
Squashed flies in it didn't do it for me.
I think
some
it's
chocolate chip thing.
Really? A chocolate chip thing?
Yeah. All right, Dunk. You've taken the mickey out of us. What are you going with?
I'm really vanilla, I'm afraid, in this particular case, which is a dark chocolate digestive.
Oh, after all that hobnob banter.
It'd be dull, isn't it?
What a terrible end to a brilliant podcast. Oh, well. Right, well, thank you for listening to yet another Pilot Episodes podcast. If you want to support our show, please go onto Twitter, follow us there. Goddess, where are we?
At Pilot Episodes Pod.
And I suppose at some point I'm going to have to do some sort of Facebook page. I'll get onto that, I am sure. But most importantly, please leave us an iTunes review. That's what really matters. It lets other people know what we're about, pushes up the charts, and just helps spread the word a tiny bit for our humble endeavour. And actually, before we go, just remind everyone for the books that we mentioned today.
Okay, so we spoke about The Big Show, which is by Pierre Klosterman, about his experiences going through France on the way to Germany in World War II, and also Skunk Works, talking about Lockheed Martin's innovative Skunk Works that came up with the SR-71 and other fantastic aircraft, and that's by...
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
And are rich.
Excellent. So from Godders, Skullcrusher, and of course, the newly named Big Tone. Goodbye, and probably see you in a couple of weeks' time.